That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, and welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Very excited to have co-worker Bomani Jones on the podcast today. You may remember, if you are a longtime listener to the pod, that Bomani came on back in 2016, just a couple months into the podcast. And I had him on not to talk about his career and his rise to ascension at ESPN, but rather a very specific topic that I was incredibly interested in and thought he would be a smart and thoughtful person to talk to about it. And he was. This was right after Justin Timberlake got some flack for tweeting about being inspired by activist and actor Jesse Williams at the BET Awards, who had given this very moving speech. And people accused Timberlake of not understanding his own role in appropriating black culture. And it led me down this sort of path of trying to understand the difference between cultural appreciation and cultural appropriation. And if you want to check that podcast out, you can go back and search for it. Just Google Sarah Spain, Bomani Jones, cultural appropriation. It'll come up. It's a really fascinating conversation. And I don't know that we came to a final realization about how everybody views it. But I think we kind of got through a lot of the topics that come up in those conversations and tried to understand better what it means to appreciate a culture and draw from it and uplift it versus stealing from it, or that America loves black culture but not black people, and how that can be realized in the way that we listen to or watch or appreciate black culture performed by white people. It's a really interesting conversation, and you guys loved it so much that you were telling me you wanted him back on to really hear about him and how he ended up at ESPN. And it's a great conversation, really fascinating. I bet you did not know that he almost got his doctorate in economics at UNC. So really good stuff, and that's coming up next. That's Bomani Jones.
Well, that's what she said.
Happy to welcome in Bomani Jones. You can see him on Around the Horn. You can listen to his show, The Right Time, in podcast form now. In a couple months, you'll get an untitled new show with him and Pablo Torre. Had him on the pod before, but not to talk about his career and his past and everything else. So I'm happy to get to know you a little bit more. And I want to start at the very beginning. Back in Atlanta and Texas, your formative years. Tell me a little bit about your family and how you grew up.
Yeah, so I was born in Atlanta. We actually did a year in Nigeria when I was 3 years old. We went over there, which, you know, gives you back a couple of interesting stories. And then we moved to Houston when I was, like, right before I turned 7, and we lived there till I graduated from high school, which was right before I turned 17. My parents are college professors, which is, I mean, the thing about having, like, college professors for parents is you don't get to pass a whole lot of nonsense through. Like, there's not a whole lot. There's not a lot of indulging the child just for having the thought. Like, right. There's a real adult level of scrutiny that you get for whatever it is that you have to say up until that point. But, yeah, I grew up in Houston. I went to school in a town called Waller, about 20 miles outside of Houston. We lived in a suburban neighborhood right outside of Houston. So it's like, in a way, I'm from everywhere, from nowhere. Right. All at once. Then went to college in Atlanta at Clark Atlanta University for the next 4 years. Bounced around, did a couple of years in California for graduate school. Then went to North Carolina, thinking I was going to get a PhD at the University of North Carolina. Instead, I flunked out of graduate school 2 years after showing up, and then stuck around for another 8. At which point, I was, you know, freelance writing and doing all, you know, basically the start of doing this stuff.
Right.
And somehow they keep letting me do it.
Yeah, so let's go back. You said you graduated high school just before you were 17?
Yeah.
So you were like Doogie Howser-esque? Not quite a full-time doctor at that point, but you were ahead of the game.
Yeah, I was ahead of the game. I tell you, though, the interesting thing about that is, like, on one level, you feel cool when you skip a grade because people just think it's kind of a mind-blowing concept. And it's all fun and games until about, like, seventh grade. Because then everybody else is, like, growing up, and you're the dude that's a year younger than everybody else. And my birthday is in, like, late August. So I'm at the end of that year's cycle anyway. And then we throw another year on top of it. But I remember there was some program, I think the University of North Texas was doing this program, where what you would do is you would go after your sophomore year of high school, and you would basically do your last 2 years of high school and your time in college in a 4-year period. and that would have had me out when I was 18. And I remember it sounded like the coolest like thing and notion in the world, because you could tell people, ooh, I graduated college when I was 18. Man, I can't imagine what a socially maladjusted weirdo I would have been if that would have happened. Like the best move the parents ever made was looking at that and being like, nah, bro, no way.
Go to school. Yeah, yeah. What did your parents teach?
My father teaches political science and my mother teaches economics.
So they're still teaching now?
Well, as you know, they are now both retired. My mother, we never thought she would retire, because it's hard to imagine her without being on campus. But she retired last year. My father's been retired now, I guess, I wasn't going to say 15 years, but it's like somewhere around 15 years ago he retired. And then he realized he was a little too energetic and needed some more work to do. So then he went back to work and then realized he really didn't want to go to work anymore. And so a couple of years after that, he went on about his business.
That's funny. Yeah, but neither of my parents have yet retired. They're the same way, where we're trying to figure out what it would look like for them to have free time. We're not sure that they're down with that yet. So we're waiting.
See, my parents are like legitimately old at this point, though.
Right.
Like they are very much so like retirement age now.
Right.
This is the thing that they should be doing. But like, I think my dad got, after that second run, my dad got pretty comfortable with that not having anything to do. My mom was still trying to figure out how that works.
Right, right. Well, both my parents are lawyers, so I feel like it was the same thing. We didn't get away with much. And the conversations were, everyone's always playing devil's advocate, which is why I end up essentially being a lawyer for sports, where I have to argue.
Oh, that sounds like the most annoying thing in the world.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Like, that's the one thing. If I've learned anything in my experiences in dating, lawyers are the worst, because it's just like, hey, man, I understand that you have questions. I might not have answers.
My husband always says, it's not fair to fight with you because you remember everything word for word, and I can't remember anything. And I'm like, well, sorry. I'm just always going to be right then. That's the way it goes.
You guys are so technical.
Right, right. I want to hear about economics, because to study economics as your bachelor's degree and then love it enough to follow it up with a master's in politics, economics, and business, and then another master's, and going towards a doctorate, what was it about that was so exciting to you?
Well, so I will say, and this is where it gets interesting and perhaps probably why I don't do it anymore, is let us not assume that path was truly one that was born out of love. When I was in college, I actually started college as a chemistry major. I wanted to be a pediatrician. Like, that was the plan at first. And then I realized I didn't like doing all the science and math. Like, I just really wasn't feeling it. So I did a lot of bouncing around with majors. And at one point, I went with economics because I had taken an economics course, and it was like the most legitimately challenging thing that I had done in college. And so I was like, yeah, okay, cool. Let's go ahead and ride that out. And then I decided, no, I don't want to do that anymore. And then I had a couple balls bounce in such a way where I was like, okay, I just need to hurry up and get out of school. And that was the quickest path to get out. So if you were to ask me before I graduated from college what I was going to do after graduation, my answer was going to get something to eat. And if you're looking long run, the only thing I can tell you is that I'm not going to go to graduate school in economics. 3 months later, I was in graduate school in economics because I had, like, I think I had this grand notion that I was going to be a writer. Like, I had already kind of gone down that path, and I started making a little bread freelancing. And so I had a grave misunderstanding of what the life of a freelancer was. Like,
right.
I just did not realize how broke they were. Like, I remember at one point, it was like April of that year, and I was talking to a dude who's freelancing, and he was doing his taxes, and he told me how excited he was because he had just got through adding everything up, and he had made $10,000 that year freelancing. I was like, you mean like all of it?
You're like, not just one story?
Yeah. I was like, wait a minute. Like that's all you get is like $10,000? Or are you telling me you got another? Oh, whoa, wait
right.
a minute.
So, you like, got a couple other jobs? Uh-oh.
Yeah, like my whole thought of what my life was going to be had kind of flipped up. So part of how I wound up deciding to go ahead and do the course of study in economics was I thought that if I could get myself in a place, well, A, I didn't have any idea what to do, so I figured that was a good way to buy time.
That's the answer for most people who go to grad school.
Yes. Yeah, it is that, right? Like, I wasn't paying for it, so there was something to it.
Right.
But the other part was, like, I looked at what the course of study was for that program, and I thought it would be stuff that would be really good as background for, like, writing stuff that I wanted to do. Like, that was a means toward, I would not have considered it a media career at the time, but that was really, for me, it was a means to do that. And then I kind of thought a little bit more about it, and I was like, okay, so I'm looking at a lot of these, you know, the so-called public intellectuals out there in space. And I was like, okay, there aren't that many economists, though, right? Like, I could, if I could get a PhD in this, you know, keep this media thing going, I could put myself in a place where I'm kind of fairly unique in the game. And so then I said, okay, cool, let's go with this PhD thing. And then I get into that program, and you got to love it to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, if you really want to do a PhD in anything, and I can say specifically in economics, you got to really, really, really love it. And I absolutely 100% did not love it. Like, I remember I sat down with a guy I was in the program with right before we started, and I told him, I was like, look, I got a decision that I've made about how hard I'm willing to work to do this, about how much I'm willing to expend in this, and if I can't get it done with this level of work that I want to put in, then it's just not going to happen. Now, after that, I would say that I put in more effort than I thought I would have on the front end, if not for if nothing else. But
right.
I didn't want to fail. Yeah, right. Like, no, you don't want that sort of embarrassment, but I didn't love it in that way. But what ultimately like wound up being helpful from it was it's a thought process, and I have a grounding and a foundation that allows me, I feel like, to approach and attack any sort of problem to get to some sort of answer. Like, it's not a thought process that's going to solve everything, give you every answer in the world. But it wound up being the level of economics that I came to understand wound up being kind of the level of knowledge and understanding of it that I really wanted and that I could use to kind of apply to things. So
right.
It wasn't a matter of loving it at first as much as I found it to be really, really effective.
Now,
and
do you
that's
think
the
that,
part that,
that
probably endures.
Right. Is that the part that interested you from the beginning, too? More of a process of how things should be done versus the nitty-gritty?
Yeah, no, it was just a lot to kind of just think about, right? Like, I mean, I think that for a lot of people who fancy themselves as, like, being smart on the front end, that you think as smart as knowing things as much as anything else, right? Like, you know, you can memorize, somebody tells you something once, you can spit it right back to them. Like, you think about the things that kids might do that you think are really, really smart, and often is the ability to memorize something and then
right.
throw it back. And I think that most of us, when we go through school, the approach that we would take on a lot of stuff was just that, right? You're going to memorize the stuff, you're going to throw it back. This wound up being a process to walk through. Like, it wasn't just a matter of I'm trying to learn this one thing or I'm trying to learn how to do this one thing. It was kind of like, okay, so you're giving me this, and now I'm taking that in order to figure out how to do a bunch of stuff. And I do think that that, like, wound up being kind of cool. But, like, for the college part of it, though, it felt – basic is not the right word. It felt more like kind of cold and sterile. Like, you know, you do supply and demand curves and stuff like that. Like, I mean, there's not a lot of fun to be had in doing that. Now, when I got to my first graduate stop, though, I started, like, taking some courses that gave a much better understanding of how you can take this stuff and apply it. Like, you know, people use it, it's applied and used as, like, a behavioral science.
Right. Behavioral economics is fascinating to me.
Yeah,
really,
like,
fascinating. Take the math out of it and I'm down.
Yeah, like, I didn't know that stuff existed. Like, I didn't realize that there were as many things that you could kind of apply this thought process to. Political economy was another one I thought was really, really cool. Like, I just had no idea that you could do those things, and I really enjoyed them when I did them. And then I started doing the PhD program at a different school, and that wasn't what they were doing at all. It was like, oh,
right.
I'm sorry. I thought I was signing up for something just a little bit different, you know? But
right.
I can use it for a lot of stuff. I can walk you through a lot of things. And if you learn how to, like, if you learn how to talk about economics, do it in English, it can be really helpful. And people
yeah,
can
for
find
sure.
it to be very, very interesting
sure.
as long as you're not talking like a jerk about it.
Right. So UNC is a great school and a place that you probably felt accomplished going to get a doctorate there. Did you fail out because you realized you didn't care, or because it was hard, or it wasn't your aptitude, or what was the decision that allowed you to fail at something in terms of dropping out and being kicked out?
Yeah, that's a good question.
You don't strike me as someone who would be willing to accept defeat.
No, I tell this all the time, that was probably the first time in my life that I'd experienced something that I think, you know, could be objectively deemed to be failure. And
right.
that was a bit of a monster, because I was never the hardest working person in the world, but I had always felt as though I could do anything. And so what happened with that was, once I got in that program, which beats everybody up, right? Like, it's a graduate study in economics is can be abusive to the students. Like, everybody's miserable. Nobody's just breezing through this. You know, even the people that look like it, you find out, are, you know, in misery when nobody else is around. Like, that's just kind of how it feels to everybody while they're in the course of doing it. And so I wasn't happy doing it. I had these other things I was doing that I was like happy with, right? So I'm, you know, doing writing, I'm doing music criticism and all of that stuff, and I'm really enjoying that. And then I'm coming back over here, and I'm trying to do this stuff that, like, I feel like I understand, but I had no practice whatsoever on the front end of working hard. And you really get through a program like that, you needed to know, like, how it was working. I didn't even know what it was to work hard. Like, I didn't realize what the level of output was that people are putting into things in order to get it done. Like, I learned a whole lot right there about what happens when you're up against something. Like, I imagine it's a lot like rookies in professional sports, where you've been cruising through high school, you've been cruising through college, and now all of a sudden everybody's fast, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's strong. Everybody can do all this, except everybody is these damn math problems that ain't even got numbers. It's just a bunch of letters. And so, you know, it reached a point, though, where I just, you know, you take qualifying exams, and we have a macro qual and a micro qual. And the first time we took them, I passed the macro. I didn't pass the micro. And then, so that was in August. And then in January is when you took it for the second time. So the semester ends in the middle of December. And then you basically just grind until you do the retake. And they're showing up at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning to get started. I'm showing up whenever I damn well please. They staying at that bad boy till 10, 11 o'clock at night. I'm getting dinner, and then I'm going to figure the rest out from there. Right. Like, I can't pretend as though I was the most fully invested person in it, but I also don't have an answer for if I were to have, like, invested myself fully in it, would the how much different would the outcome right. have been? Like, I would love to say, well, if I had just worked, you know, if I had just done X, Y, and Z, I would have been just fine. I don't know that. I will never know that. And it's like, I think it wasn't for me really a matter of accepting defeat as much as I needed, let's just say that I could not do that. Like, let's just say that I was incapable of it.
Right. Well, you were just applying economics to your scarcity of time and resources, and they were better allocated elsewhere, and you realized that. And that was the lesson you were meant to learn all along. That was the real doctorate.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that's the way I love to rationalize it, right? Like, that was it. But also, I mean, if I were not a good enough economist to get a PhD in it, that didn't make me any less of anything.
Right.
And that,
right.
I think, was the ultimate lesson that I got from that was, I mean, that was, for me, a pretty embarrassing level of failure to endure. But I was still whoever I was before. Like, the world just kept on going.
You learned to pivot, right? And then you end up pivoting many, many times in the time after that. You're doing music and pop culture. You're bouncing around. You know, you're at ESPN.com for a bit. You're doing local radio. In that span, before you became sort of a regular, let's say before 2010, when you launched The Morning Jones, and that was sort of how you really got settled and bounced your way up. Before that time, from the end of UNC to then, what did that freelancing, bouncing around movement feel like to you? Was it always, did it feel linear, like you were headed in the right direction all along?
Yeah, no, because most of the pivots were not my own decision, right? So
okay.
Yeah, so like when I leave school, part of leaving school is that, you know, you got a stipend while you were there. So I had a stipend on my fellowship. Then on top of that, I had been writing these music columns that were paying like $600 a week. So I was making like adult money in a place that did not require a lot to live. I had bought a house. Like, I really like felt like an adult. But then the grad school thing ends, and that $600 a week column turns into a $100 a week blog. Like, and all that happens basically at one time. So it's like, ooh, we have to figure out how to get, like, the money game going there. And then after that, I got lucky. I, you know, talked to some ESPN people about some stuff. And, you know, that's when I started, like, regularly contributing to Page 2. But I was doing that as a freelancer. And I had to do a kicking and screaming routine in order to convince some people to sign me to a one-year contract. That was, like, the first time that I'd ever had a gig that I knew, like, for 12 months was going to pay something. Like, I got in there, but that wasn't, I mean, if I'm being honest, it wasn't a great experience, at least not for my mental health or anything like that. Like, I did some pretty good work, and I was able to learn some things. But when the company made the decision that they were not going to renew that contract, I had no idea what in the world it was that I was going to do. And so I, you know, taught a class at Duke that pays the bills, and I started doing the radio thing on weekends. But even then, there was no job there for me, at least it didn't look like. And then suddenly a job was there for me that summer. And then that rolled for about a year and change. And then after that, that radio station, like, I was going to go in to ask for a raise because I had just done really well at the ratings. And the day I had planned to go ask for a raise, we found out that the radio station is being sold. And that night, I read in a press release that my time slot was going to somebody else. Read in a press release. So, no, it did not feel linear at that point. I parlayed that into the satellite gig, and that was cool. And then that operation shuttered. And I really did. I remember, like, the gentleman who is now my agent, he had been trying to get me on board for a while, and I called him after that happened because I just had no idea what to do. And I remember I was sitting in a car in a parking lot at a Chick-fil-A because I wanted to talk to him before I ordered my food. And I do remember I just had a point where I broke down crying, and I was just like, why does this keep happening? Right? Like, I felt like I was doing good work, and the doing good work was never good enough, and a bunch of stuff that had happened just, like, wasn't really my fault.
But why do you still think that? Do you, when you look back now, do you look at, so, I mean, the radio station being sold, that doesn't feel like that's you, but moments when you were fired or let go or they did something different, do you still feel like it wasn't anything you did?
Well, I guess I would say on these, I use the word fault very kind of particularly on that. Like, I don't think that the contract not being renewed when I was writing for Page 2, that happening was my fault. It was a chain of circumstances that was not, I think, what anybody thought they were signing up for in the first place. And right. I certainly was in a position where I didn't know exactly what I was doing, but everybody involved knew that I didn't know what I was doing. That's what we right. had going in the first place. So, like, that couldn't be the
case. We agreed that I don't know what I'm doing. You can't expect me to all of a sudden know.
Yeah. Like we talked about this. So, yeah. There were, like, there's some other things that are not, like, quite for public consumption that went on there. But, no, I don't feel like that was my fault
right.
when that happened. Like me failing out of grad school, for example. Yeah, that's my fault. Ain't nobody else to put that on. Like, I could give you, like, big macro-level examples as to how, you know, everything came together for that point in life. But, no. I did not do what there was to be done in that place. And boom, that's how that wound up happening and going. The thing where I had the column that turned into a blog, that was a corporate decision. Those things happened, but that was absolutely a corporate decision. But no, it's like I did feel kind of at that point where these two places didn't go out of business, you know, and everything else. It's just like, so what exactly is it that I'm supposed to do now?
Right.
But somehow stuff just kept happening. Like, I'd get a good break, you know, and then
what did the agent say?
You got to hold on to it.
What did the agent say?
Well, the agent at that time was not my agent, so he's like, yo, why don't you let me go out here and help you get this money? That's where that went. And honestly, since then, everything's kind of been coming up aces since that point.
So that's when you start doing Outside the Lines, Around the Horn. Is that around the same time, 2010?
Yeah, 2010. So what had happened with 2010 was I came back to Page 2. Like, I started doing some blogging contributions for Page 2 at the beginning of 2010. But what that then allowed me to say was that I was kind of back under the ESPN umbrella. And then once that happened, I started getting on and doing the Outside the Lines appearances. And something I don't think people quite get when they watch on TV is that, like, so you can be on a run somewhere where you're getting on TV a lot, and people will be like, oh, man, you know, the company's really starting to see what you're doing. Man, the company don't know who the hell you are. You're just another person that's on Outside the Lines. But the producers on Outside the Lines, or the host or whatever, they do know who you are. And so they greatly appreciated what I contributed, and I was always available. Like, when you do a morning radio show, you're off at 10 o'clock. So there was never a day where I could not jump in the car for 1 o'clock to jump, you know, to roll down there and be on. So, you know, like, I got to keep that going and rolling. And Outside the Lines is actually, like, great practice for the other stuff that I've done on television. You kind of got to get in and get out. You got to be able to react to what people are going to say that you don't know is going to come. You know, you got to figure out how to kind of put some punch on some topics that aren't necessarily the most exciting to the average viewer. And so once I was doing that, then more people happened to come across those things. They happened to see them. Social media thing was kind of going at that point, so I was kind of getting some attention from people who might not have otherwise known anything about me if they had not come across me on Twitter, whatever it is. And then from there, I get onto Around the Horn, and I did the first Around the Horn appearance, and I'm adamant about this. I said this for a while. I was like, I have two ways that I can approach this. I can either go about this as though I hope they call me back and do everything I can to make sure they call me back, or I can go about this as if they are never going to call me back, so we might as well make this thing. Saying this one time that we do it. And I went with B, and B worked.
And you were a breath of fresh air, something they hadn't seen before or expected.
Yeah, I think I was a breath of fresh air for some people. I think there was a whole lot of who the hell is he from some others, which was right. Perfectly legitimate. Like, I looked at it, I forget when I happened to see this, but the first time, I think it's when I got to like 100 wins on Around the Horn and they had done some package. And the first thing that I'd ever said when I was on Around the Horn was, is it just me or did this panel just get a whole lot better looking?
That's funny. The first thing I said was, hello, losers, to everybody else.
Yeah. Can you imagine? And I always think about this because I had just turned 30 when that had happened. And I'm like, I really look back on it and try to imagine. If I'm one of these people, like, keep in mind that pretty much everybody who had done Around the Horn, not absolutely everybody, but pretty much everybody who had done Around the Horn before I got there had come out of this newspaper tradition,
right.
People who had seen
yeah.
each other on the road, they kind of knew each other. Man, nobody knew who in the world that
yeah,
I was.
Yeah, I said that to Jackie McMullen, and like four shows later when I got used to doing it, I was like, what was I thinking? Just rolling with the hello losers.
I feel like hello losers, they kind of like, okay, this is way over the top, whatever it was. Like, I look back at that clip of me saying this panel just got a whole lot better looking, and I'm like, oh, wow, I look dead ass serious. Like, I look so serious in this place. I can only wonder what some of their thoughts were
yep.
the first time that they had ever come across me.
Love it. All right, so you're doing Around the Horn Outside the Lines, and meantime, you are also doing the internet radio show and also working for SB Nation. Were those all kind of simultaneous?
Yeah, so when the satellite gig ended in August, I want to say, of 2011, and then I signed on with SB Nation somewhere around December, give or take, is when I got on with them. And it was cool because we had to kind of run it by ESPN to make sure that, you know, if I signed a gig with them, would I still be able to get on Around the Horn, you know, and do all that stuff. The SB Nation gig was great. Like, I was working on, like, they had gotten a grant from YouTube to make video content. And so me and a couple of guys that I had worked with before, we were separate from the larger operation, but we were just in there just making stuff. They had the facilities and the cameras and all of those things. Like, my profile was starting to rise, and we just get together and just be like, okay, two times a week, let's make it happen. So what are we going to do this time? Like, it wasn't like we were walking, like, there were no, like, Google Docs as we planned this stuff out and everything else. No, I just show up after I got done doing Around the Horn or something like that day. We sit together. Somebody's probably sitting in there playing a guitar, playing a piano, or something like that. We're laughing at the world, thinking about this. Everybody's got the other gigs. And they'd be like, okay, so what's the topic we're going to do today? And then we figure out what the topic was. I'd sit there and try to bang out a script. We get that put in the teleprompter. And then they kind of work with me off camera to try to, you know, like, move me and not go. That wouldn't be the right word. But just, you know, get the right clips and everything together. And I'd leave. They, you know, 2 days later, they'd put this whole thing together. And boom, it'd be on the internet. And week after week after week, we had stuff that we were very happy with.
So I went back and watched... The first one, the show was called Bomani and Jones, which cracks me up because you are sort of, up until this endeavor with Pablo and, of course, your work with Dan on Highly Questionable, you're sort of a solo artist. And so the fact that you had a show that was named Bomani and Jones because you never have a partner cracked me up. But what is it about that whole beginning stretch? Why do you think you always were doing solo shows at every level? Because that's not usually how people break in.
Yeah, I did solo stuff on the radio when I was in Raleigh, but I pretty much everybody that worked at that station at that time was doing solo stuff. Like, that wasn't an operation at that moment that was pairs. Like, there were, you know, it's not that nobody was working with a pair, but, you know, pretty much everybody was kind of working solo. And I, like, for radio, for me, for example, I don't think on radio that it makes a great deal of sense to put me with somebody. Like, I think the advantages that you get from having me on radio and letting me stretch out and go in all the directions that I want to go in. Like, it's hard for me to find somebody that I can trust is going to go the place that I want to go with whatever topic happens to be. And you can't do a solo act with two people pulling in kind of opposite directions. So, like, for radio, it's a grind to do it by yourself, but I think that's the best way to use me. On television, I don't think that anybody really works solo. Unless,
it's like, tough.
Well, not anybody.
Well, like a John Oliver or a Jon Stewart. Like, it takes a very special kind of talent and brain, and also the audience has to want that, which in sports I think is tougher to sell. People want that debate aspect of it.
Yeah, it's got to be like the right structure, right? So like the Scott Van Pelt Sports Center, for example, works as a solo. Like, yeah, you're bringing other people in, you know, and stuff like that. But on television, you know, Poppy, we all love him, but, you know, when the show was Dan Le Batard is Highly Questionable, that was really Dan, and Dan was responsible for generating a significant amount of the content by itself. And you need other voices. You need other people to kind of work themselves in a way to work on television. On radio, you kind of need it also. But there are some people that I think are better in that space when you allow them to have all the space to roam. Rather than, I think there are other people where they are best when you whittle away the fat from what it is that they're talking about, and you keep them somewhere where they're kind of focused or locked into a role or a dynamic within a group chemistry. I think that they're just other people that you let go do their own thing.
Right. So you're now settling into ESPN more often. You end with SB Nation at 2013, and there's a little crossover with that and you starting to be on HQ. And then 2013, a couple months after you end things with SB Nation, you sign a 4-year deal with ESPN. So that's when everybody really starts to see you regularly on Highly Questionable, Around the Horn, your radio show, everything else. So not too much longer that you get this opportunity with Pablo Torre. You know, a lot of people are at ESPN for a long time looking for the right outlet. And you presumably are walking into this new project with Pablo, that is formed entirely based on the amount of time that you guys have had to prep for it, which we like to dig on Pablo because he doesn't have a radio show. So I don't know what the hell he's been up to for the last couple months other than just like hanging out. But presumably you've been able to create this. What can you tell us about it so far based on what you and Pablo are thinking about what the space needs?
I don't know anything. It's the funniest thing in the world up until this point. I know so little about what it's
How is that possible?
It is possible.
What have you guys been doing for these months?
Well, we trust the people who are in charge of putting this show together. And when they believe that we need to talk about some things or know about some things, they will let us know those things. And it's been a while since anybody felt like they needed to talk to me about some stuff. I think I'm supposed to meet with somebody this weekend in the city. Perhaps to talk about it, but like the part I can say though is I think the basis of this show will be a lot of the relationship and chemistry that I have with Pablo. So like a significant difference between doing this show and doing Highly Questionable were two differences. One is that Highly Questionable, when I got there, was a formed project. Like all they did was pull up a chair, and then we figured out, you know, how to get everybody to work together. But what it was already established. The other thing though that's different is, I've known Pablo for years now. Like, I hang out with Pablo. We are good friends. I got to know Dan on television, right? Like, that was the relationship that developed in front of everybody else. This is different because people will have something to, like, will have something to work off of that will probably encapsulate both of our personalities and the shared relationship that we have in a different way. And so I think the biggest thing about this show that a lot of, I think, observers are selling short is that this is going to be a lot of fun. Like, I'm in this for the fun. I'm in this for the joke. This is why I'm here. I think, you know, Pablo having gone to Harvard and the things that people think about me is that their assumption, like our good buddy Matt Kelleher, who works on Part of the Interruption, had joked that he thought that the perfect title for the show would be Pablo and Bomani Talk Down to You.
Like, yeah, that's a lot of the assumptions, for sure.
Yeah, but I feel like those people who operate on that assumption haven't paid very much attention to either one of us and what it is that we actually do.
Right, or they're the kind of people that are very sensitive about feeling like they're not as smart as someone else, and instead of wanting to be taught something or learn or be educated or be stimulated, they would rather play down because it hurts their heart to know that they are not smart enough to keep up.
Yeah, look, I spent 4 years on television watching animal videos. Like, I don't know know what more that I can do to establish to people that I am in this for the partay. Like that's why we're here. And one thing, like, I find when I hang out with Pablo, we laugh a lot. Like, that's what we do. My best friend from growing up was in town last week. And he came over, and Pablo was here. We hung out. We went and got some pizza. We just came back here. And all we did was just sit around here and laugh about stuff. Like, that's what this is. So, yeah, there are going to be places where the stuff is going to require a smart person to approach it and deal with it properly. But I am not interested. Like, if I wanted to get on TV to show off to everybody how smart I was, I wouldn't be doing sports.
Right, right. That's so true. You know, it's interesting. I think there's two schools of thought, and there's crossover in the middle, which I think a lot of people sit in the middle. But some people think a new show needs to have a new concept. Like, what's different and interesting about this visually, or what? How are they doing things differently? And then others say it's really just a matter of chemistry. I tend to lean more towards chemistry, because if you look at PTI, it's not that different from every other debate show. If you look at Desus and Mero, it's two dudes sitting in a chair with a rundown. Those things work because of the chemistry. How much are you worried about whether the concept of your show is different than what's out there versus just saying, it's me and Pablo, that's what matters?
Well, I would say that people I've talked to working around this show want it to be visually different than anything that is on the air. And those are people that I trust. So we'll see what they come up with. Like, that part's not my job. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, I don't like, I think that I will see things and I will have ideas and I will have thoughts about whether or not those are the ways that I want to be represented. But I think a very important part of working in this business is you have to be in a situation where you trust that the people who produce your show can get the best version of you that there is. And I have that faith in the people that we are going to be working with, that they know how to get the best out of me. They know how to make me look the best that I'm supposed to look. They know how to make Papa look the best he's supposed to look, and they'll make two of us look the best that we are supposed to look. So then from there, I don't feel like I have a whole lot of bad days on television. I'm sure that I do, right? But I don't feel that way. Like, I feel like I can pretty consistently go out there and give you good stuff. And if I have a day where I don't give you good stuff, it ain't going to be so bad that they're not going to let me come back tomorrow.
Right.
Like,
right.
All that stuff over there, I think that we are going to be able to figure out as a pair. I think, like, I got kind of a leg up a little bit. I tell Pablo this all the time. Like, I've been doing television 5 days a week now for a while. Like, it is different. Like, you can go on TV and do something once or twice a week or whatever it is, but it's a different ball game when you're on there every day, 5 days mm-hmm. a week, week after week after week. You get so much better, so much faster as you've had that kind of time and opportunity to do that. So I figure once we get on the air and we get this talking and rolling with the collection of people that we have, I think we'll be able to make something good.
So you're incredibly confident. You know how you want things done. I wonder how that sort of control aspect of your personality, along with someone who's been usually smarter and more on track than the people around him, how does that fit with being required to give up some control in terms of believing in other people, whether that's producers or editors or, you know, ESPN's content heads who say this is what we want or need? How have you been able to adjust, like, your natural approach to things to say that you're okay with, like, putting your trust and your success in someone else's hands in some way?
It's a gradual learning process.
It's hard.
That for me. I think part of it is spending time writing is helpful because you have to turn things over to editors. And it's been very rare that I've turned something over to an editor and they did not make it better. Even editors that I despised, I found that overwhelmingly. And I had great experience with editors over the years, so I found that overwhelmingly that they made my work better. But the part for me, like when I first started doing radio, I was very, very much so a control freak about everything that was there. Like, I do all the stuff with my own hand. Part of it was I want to learn how to do things within it. But also, like, I was like, I know how I want things to look, and I need these things to look exactly the way that I want them to look. Now, when I started doing the videos with my guys, Hayes and Chip, with SB Nation, I remember the first time we did a video, I spent a lot of time with them, and I was like, I want to see how you're doing it and see if I like this or whatever it is, and da-da-da. And then I realized that process itself was kind of cumbersome, so it really wasn't going to work. And I would leave, and then I would come back, and the stuff would be good. And then the thing I think that really overwhelmingly, like, got me to realize I had to let people do what it was that they did was I would come in there and have a day where I did not think I had a good day. I'd leave, I'd come back, and the video would be great. And they were noticing things that I myself would not have noticed. They were picking up on things that I would not, because I'd have been so locked in on what I wanted to do that I probably would have missed out on a lot of those things. And so what I want in all the stuff that I do, if I'm working with somebody else on content, I want that other person's mark to be on the content. I want that other person to have their ideas, because I feel like their ideas combined with mine are going to be so much better than just me and this, like, a tight-fisted idea of what it is that I need to be. And so, like, I'm on HQ working with Eric Reinholdt, who's best at this. And that, I mean, that'll make you a truster really, really quick. Like, I know I put something in that guy's hands, it'll be okay when it gets done. And yeah. He hadn't led me astray yet.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing everyone's looking for, right? Is like that team. That's the thing I miss most about improv, is just walking into a room full of really smart, funny people and then feeling like we were going to create something great. That's harder to find in this industry because it is a lot of work on your own, and it is a lot of trying things out until you meet up with the right people, which hopefully is the case for you and Pablo. I'm going long as always, so before we let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does. Nobody expects it. It's the Spanish Inquisition.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Oh, man, I wish I was natural talent. Oh, I really, really wish I was good at basketball. Like, I would just, like, that's just something I would like to be able to say I was good at basketball.
Were you good at any sport?
I was good at baseball when I was younger, but, like, you know, that grade-skipping thing affects your whole playing in school situation,
right.
You know, along with being ridiculously thin. I wasn't bad at playing basketball, right? But I want to be good at playing basketball where you show up at any place and you're like, all right, I'm up there next. You know, like, you know you're going to get picked up on the next squad. I would love to have that piece of mind.
Slight aside, have you ever in your career in sports been accused of not belonging because you never played the game and also didn't even go to college for it?
Oh, yeah, all the time. All the time.
Really? I was going to say, I wonder if just, like, the like, kind of skinny, tall, black dude just doesn't get that because people are like, oh, yeah, he probably was a baller somewhere.
Oh, no. You know, and it's funny because, you know, I always laugh when people mistake me for, like, you know, did you ever play ball? Because I'm like, yo, you have no idea how big these guys actually are.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
like, I moved to Miami and, you know, living in this high-rise building, and, you know, that was their guess. Right, they're just like it's not just that you're here, but you're here in basketball shorts. Like, it's you know, a lot of things that are going into that. But I'm just like, you have no idea like how large these.
Yeah, you would get tossed around.
Are.
Yeah.
Oh God, it'd be terrible. I'm tall, man. I'm not big man. I'm tall.
Yeah, exactly.
Man. But yeah, no. People love that when you can't talk about it because you never played the game. And I'm always trying to figure out like what level qualifies
right
as playing
right
the game. Because they put so many people playing college ball anywhere. Like, is your requirement that to be on the air or anything to talk about these games that you had to play college ball? Let me tell you, the content wouldn't be nearly as good.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Number two, what's your desert island album? You could only have one.
Oh, man. I go through so many of these. But I would say my desert island album, there we go, that would probably have to be Bob Marley's Kite.
Mm. And it would be fitting for a desert island.
That's what I'm saying. If I'm gonna be on an island, right?
Right.
Like, I might as well enjoy.
Lean in.
There you go.
Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Switch lives with anybody for a day, how would it be? When I was in college, I would always say to rapper Devin the Dude, because Devin the Dude had basically just scored out a life of the ultimate simplicity. Like, all his albums and every song. It's like a very, like, peculiar Houston, like, Jimmy Buffett thing,
right,
where it's basically, I'm just trying to get lit, and I'm trying to snuggle up with some lady by the end of the night. That was it. That was
get
like,
lit and get laid. Yeah.
Yeah, at 22. At 37, you know, could be worse. But at 22, that was the height.
Right. All right, well, I'm giving you that one. That's what you're getting. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
That is a good question. The most scared I have ever been. If you ask my parents, it would probably be one of those times I had malaria when we lived in Nigeria, being in the hospital.
Oof. Yikes.
That involved a great deal of fright. I did get robbed one time, and I don't think I was really that scared. Actually, no, it wasn't scary until one of the other people who was also getting robbed, whom we did not know, he kept talking. He kept like, come on, man, don't take my stuff. I'm like, y'all just shut up and get robbed. The
right.
Only job we have to play in this robbery is the people getting robbed. There's no performance element of this. Like, that's not what we're here for. That part was scary. Once they said we could go, it was good. But, yeah, that part when the stranger looked like he was about to get us clapped That was
right. Big. Yeah, that's no good. Number five, what would you consider your biggest failure?
I guess I would say failed out of graduate school.
Yeah, because it's the only legit one. We'll point
that's
to
a big one. Yeah, like I don't like you know, because I think people like greatly overstate the notion of what failure is, and even that. I mean, I failed at that one thing, you know, but as far as, you know, like the list of failures go, they can get a whole lot worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because most of us who find success find a way to spin everything into something that we learned and grew and all that jazz. Like, rarely do you just fail and then things get worse progressively from there.
Yeah,
and then,
right.
then it's real bad. That's how you know.
Yeah, you have to, yeah, that'd be the worst. It's like, what happened? I failed. Then what? That was only the beginning.
That was it. Yeah, things went down from there. Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
If I had to say one thing, I'm a level, man. Like, you can't, it takes a lot to take me out. Like, all those things happened at various points. Like, I remember after the first radio station had gone out of business, I talked to a friend of mine. I was like, yeah, man, I'm good. And he could not believe or grasp the idea that I was, like, truly ultimately fine at that point. But I was like, look, man, worrying ain't gonna make nothing come around any faster. You know, like at some point, something's gonna happen, and I'm probably gonna make, you know, I'm gonna make the best out of what it is that could happen. And then I wound up like getting another job that made more money, and then they went out of business, and then I got another job where I was making more money. You know, it's just like something's going to come up, and I firmly believe, right or wrong, that I'm gonna be okay.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Number seven, the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve.
Ooh, the thing about myself that I would most like to improve. I always feel like I need to be a better listener. Like, I don't think I'm a bad one. And I think, like, if I really, really focus on listening and when I'm talking to people and stuff like that, that I can be very, very good at it. But I think that pretty much all of us need to be in a place, and what, like, part of doing the job that we do, or at least in the, like, with the visibility that it comes from, is you can't listen but so much.
Right.
You know, like, you have to have, so you got to be steadfast to a certain degree about, like, how it is that you're going to do whatever it is that you're going to do it. But I still feel that pretty much at all points that I could always be just a little more, like, empathetic and a little more concerned about how these things are. Like, I was watching this Chappelle special, and I've been kind of trying to figure out my thoughts on it based on what is the requisite level of empathy that I should be showing here while these things that he's saying are incredibly funny.
Yeah.
Right? That's the thing.
Well, it's interesting, too. I don't know if you've thought about it much, but I do sometimes think about some of the qualities that lead to great success in our business are not necessarily qualities that lead to great success in life. Like,
yes,
being a bloviating gas bag who really believes that everybody needs and wants to hear your opinion on everything isn't as useful in everyday life as it is on a radio show.
Well, you know how rare a talent it is, and I mean, maybe I'm patting myself on the back here, but whatever, right? Like, but do you know how rare a talent it is to be able to talk for 10 minutes on end and be entertaining? Like,
right.
There just aren't that many
right.
people who can do that. Do you realize what a not-so-great quality that is
in
real life?
Yeah.
You know, those are the things. And so, like, I think part of what happens, too, with that is, once people know that you, like, talk for a living, they then wind up putting you in positions where they ask you to talk, and then you wind up being hypnotized by the sound of your own voice almost
right.
the same way. And then
right.
next thing you know, you go from being a person who always thought they were really good at listening to having people be like, you know, I really don't feel like you listen that much.
Yep.
And
yep.
you're like, you know,
yep.
you probably have a point.
Or you find yourself realizing that people sometimes tune out things, so when you really want them to listen, you have to say, no, wait, this is good. Like, listen to this.
Yes.
Because you're like,
right,
oh no,
right.
I lost him again.
Absolutely. Talking for a living and talking for everything else, they're two different worlds.
Very different worlds. But hey, we're getting paid to talk, which when I was a kid, I did not think would happen. And it's magical. And finally,
out.
Number eight, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Three words that I would hope that people would use to describe me. I would hope that people would find me to be sincere. Like, that's a big one professionally and personally, especially professionally. Like, I think sincerity is, like, that's a big one. I would like people, at least the people who actually know me, to think that I am kind. The people who don't know me, I'm just kind of indifferent to them,
right,
or whatever it is, you know. But I would like that the people who have been, like, close to me in my life would feel like, you know, that they felt like I was a person who cared about them and cared about what happened to them. And if I could help them in any sort of way, that I would, you know, I would be that person. Like, I would hope that people would say that one. And number three is tall. I would hope that people would say that I was tall. People treat tall people better in the world. I wish
that
they, I'd like for them to notice that I'm, you know, just go ahead and call me tall. I really am just struggling to come up with a third one, so I figured I'd say something to antagonize all the little fellas out there, because I enjoy antagonizing them.
Right, so kind and antagonistic. That's a good combo.
Yeah. It's a different kind of kind, though. Like, yeah. Antagonism is love in some households.
That is true. Well, awesome. Thanks for coming on again. I got a lot of requests after you were on for just the old pod to get you on for a real one. So much appreciate you coming back, and good luck with the new show. We're all looking forward to it.
No, thanks for having me. And maybe at some point we have to do another one where you advise me how to deal with this cold weather, because I moved to New York and
right.
I don't know what the hell this is.
Yeah. I got a lot of tips for you, and they mostly involved making sure you leave town every couple weeks.
Yeah. Now, look here. I kept my dentist in Miami in part because I
there
figured I would need excuses to get out of this.
Perfect.
I got to go for my last orthodontic appointment on January to something, and I am going to be
there in Schultz.
You're
in New York, so you're not going to be driving, so you don't have to dig your car out with a shovel. You probably got a garage. Like, that's my real key for anyone in Chicago, is have enough money or pick a place that's less money than you need, so that you can make sure you park in a garage. Because there's nothing more soul sucking than waking up and digging a car out and putting a chair in a parking spot near your place, so when you get home, there's a spot.
I tell you this though, I sold Fomobile before I came up here, so I'm doing like full New York existence.
Yeah.
And part of the cold weather math that I did not do was how much time I was spending walking around in the cold.
Right, walking, waiting for a cab, waiting for a train.
Yeah.
Good luck with that. No one really feels sorry for you, but good luck with that anyway.
Yeah, I know. You know why they don't feel sorry for me? They don't feel sorry for me because I spent 4 years sending pictures from Miami during the winter of the beach and the sand and everything else. And I say the same thing. And here's what I say to all those people. If you feel like you're getting me back now, that's cool. Go outside at your beachfront condo
there
and take a picture and send it to me, and then I'll know how you feel. I hope you ain't about to do that, is you? That's right.
Awesome. Thanks, Bomani. Appreciate it.
No problem. You have a good one.
That's what she said.
This week's That's What She Read is, of course, relating to the new year, since this is the first podcast of 2018. And I know everybody always makes resolutions, and some people are so over the resolution thing that they don't even try anymore. But I read a story that I thought was actually useful in relation to resolutions. And it talked about the specificity that you need in order to accomplish things. And I was actually just talking to my husband about that. He's like, it's really dumb when people say lose weight or exercise more. You got to write it down, like exercise 4 times a week, or eat, you know, home cooked meals instead of ordering out 4 times a week. Very specific. And there's a story in Business Insider that kind of mirrored that. It's called New Year's Resolutions You Should Make Based on Science and How to Keep Them. It's by Kevin Loria. And it's kind of addresses a lot of the things that people usually try to resolve to change, but from a very fact-based approach. So if you want to lose weight and eat healthier and feel better, fix your sleeping habits, because people tend to eat worse and more when they're tired. They tend to have higher levels of proteins associated with Alzheimer's and dementia. They tend to make worse decisions for their health and their happiness when they are lacking in sleep. So rather than just fixing how you work out and what you eat, look into your sleep as well. They also talk about people saying that they want to be more productive, that they should actually work less and take more breaks, because science proves that people can only accomplish so much in a stretch before their productivity goes down. So if their energy is low, they should go for a walk or do something else that rests their brain and then come back to it. You should work fewer hours every week to be more productive, which I'm sure is a resolution we can all make. Work less, right? To read more, that there's psychological evidence that reading even literary fiction can make it easier to empathize with other people, to imagine other lives in the world, to be a better person, and to make yourself better. And then the obvious one that they mention is just to be happier. Then you need to make choices to give you more time. And so instead of buying items, buy time-saving purchases. Buy yourself some time to get in a workout or cook a meal or hang out with friends or family. So anyway, the story, like I said, businessinsider.com gives you some cool scientific ways to connect to your resolutions. It's by Kevin Loria. Check it out. And thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.